Germany has been a technology and industry leader for so many times. Keep on trying to be a leader and don't step back. And there are so many technologies this country is leading on and doesn't fully exploit. It's a little sad. Just be daring. Go.
My name is Patrick Hübscher, and this is Circularity FM, the podcast about understanding, building, and managing circular business models.
Welcome to the highlights of the Circular Republic Festival, Europe's leading event for advancing the circular economy, uniting corporates, startups, and innovators driving this transformation. We close the series with a presentation followed by a conversation about regenerative economies in practice. On stage are Michael Obersteiner, Director of the Environmental Change Institute at University of Oxford, and Miki Yokoyama, Managing Director and Partner at Aurum Impact. But before we start, I have an offer for you. If you want to get the actionable one-pager of this conversation, please sign up to the Circularity FM newsletter. You can find it at www.circularity.fm.
Good afternoon. I'm honored to be moderating the second to last session of the Circular Republic Festival this year. In the past 2 days, we've talked about different business models, technologies, platforms, innovation, a lot also in collaboration. But what does this all mean for the economy and society? I'm very happy to have Professor Michael Obersteiner, originally from Vienna, but today the director of the Environmental Change Institute at Oxford University, with tremendous research experience in biophysical modeling in the areas of ecosystems, forestry, agriculture, and so much more, and also known to be one of the most influential climate researchers in the world. He'll give us an overview on the value of circularity for planet and business. And due to the fact also that Martin Stücktei had to cancel at very short notice, we'll have much more time for discussion also afterwards. So please welcome our guest, Professor Michael Obersteiner.
The genie is out. You saw the prize winners already, and now you have to stick to an old university professor from an old university. I'm very happy that quite a few are staying on. I want to talk a little bit about why are we really after all of this. And 30 years ago, I did my first circularity study on waste paper recycling, and we came out with the number 67%. At that time, the regulation was 80%. For the first time in economics, we actually observed negative prices. So here, those who purchase a raw material, in this case waste fiber from waste paper, they actually got paid for it. This was never really seen before. Also, at that time, this was suboptimal. So in this sense, for me, the question really is, and this is why I'm standing here today, what's the right ambition for circularity and overall for the impact of managing the climate? I worked a lot and I still work a lot on climate, and we just heard it. Net zero is the goal of Germany. However, in order to make it to 1.5, we actually have proactively to take CO2 out of the atmosphere. And this will impact how I wash my clothes tomorrow, or I throw it into the waste bin and it gets burnt and CO2 gets sequestered in geological formation. So this might even really revolutionize a little bit our thinking on circularity. So let me go very quickly through a motivational set of slides on climate change. What you see here is the past 24,000 years. What's really interesting that many people don't know, sea level rise was 120 meters below at, let's say, 18,000 years. And this is how it looks. So I'm living in in the UK at the moment, and this is called Doggerland, where the island was still connected to the mainland. And this is only 18,000 years ago. At that time, we had quite a few Homo sapiens already living in Europe. If you just go further on, you see the island appearing. You also see that the Homo sapiens even made it up to Scotland. At that time, we had about 400,000 people in Europe. As it goes on, not too far away, we had the first signs of technology coming along. The wheel was actually found around Ukraine and Poland. As we go further, we basically come to our times, and as we project it further to 2200, you actually see sea level rise will eat itself into quite many lands in the Netherlands, Denmark, UK, and so forth. Of course, Munich will not be underwater, but you will receive quite a few climate refugees from the Netherlands, for example. So here we are talking today about net zero. However, if you look at how it goes up to 2500, the yellow line is 1.5. So this is what the Paris Agreement wants. If we want to stabilize sea level rise and many other climate tipping points, this will not be enough. We will actually have to go to 0 degrees in order to still see sea level rises that are kind of sustainable. And what this means is that, and here I plotted up to 2500, this is not published yet, we are about to publish this, emission trajectory up to 2500 in order to keep sea level rise at the level of 1 meter by 2500. And what you see is that we immediately have to go down. So net zero by 2050 is a good strategy. But then, and that's important, the net negative economy is here to stay for centuries. So here we have certainty that we will have to reverse CO2 out of the atmosphere. If you want to bet on certain technologies and industries, this is for sure if we don't want to sink. And this means we not only need to think about circularity, but also the net negative carbon economy. Do I bury this or do I reuse it? This will touch all of these decision-making processes. We have to think beyond circularity only, at least for carbon, but it also touches on many other circularity issues. The other circularity issue, probably the largest circularity industry and probably the very oldest, is about the nitrogen cycle in agriculture, where our ancestors took nitrogen and biomass from the surroundings to fertilize their fields. Nowadays, because of the Haber-Bosch process, we apply too much and quite inefficiently and not enough in recycling. What we are currently doing, and we published this not too long ago, we look at the question, what will circularity bring us? And this is one of the big topics we're discussing today. How is circularity beneficial in terms of supply shocks? And here we have a Ukraine supply shock, an energy supply shock, trade restrictions, weather and climate, and we do a compound. And then we look at what does this mean? And this was even a discussion today. All of these shocks on prices for commodities. So here we have maize, wheat, rice, and soybeans. And what you see, of course, first of all, there's lots of uncertainty. But for example, here an energy price shock has huge amounts of impact on EU prices of this particular commodity and potential volatility. We are currently doing, and I'm sorry I cannot show this, a World Bank project for some of the transition minerals and metals. And we have the basic, very similar insights. Of course, the prices go up a little more. And when we put recycling in, and recycling strategies in terms of nitrogen, this goes all the way from food waste to nitrogen use efficiency. What we see is with current technologies, we only take out some of the higher volatility moments, but we don't solve the problem overall. So this means we need more circularity companies, but mostly new companies that produce new proteins. For example, this is maize, this is mostly animal feed for pigs, for chicken production. If we really want to tackle this bigger issue in terms of security of supply and price risks, we need to go for new technologies. Currently, my institute is involved in one project where we look at new protein sources from fermentation, for example. This also touches the consumer side. We did a study on what are the labor market impacts of the European Green Deal. What you see here is one figure I took out of the study where we have five focus regions in Europe. With the European Green Deal, we also saw potential impacts of unemployment. So there's a reduction of unemployment. However, what's the bigger challenge, and this was also discussed today, is we see a potential labor shortage. The workforce shortage here is projected to be going up in quite many regions. And what's really interesting is in the regions where we have the highest alert on employment and out-migration, we actually see the highest shortages. So maybe we can go into more discussion on this later on. When I do an attempt of a summary, first of all, there is absolute certainty. We have death valleys in how startup companies need to perform in the realities of the economy today. However, in the long run, we need to go more circular, and we will also have to go net negative in terms of carbon, for example. So here, the longer run perspective, there are no stranded assets to be expected in that sense. The second issue is there are huge co-benefits to circularity. First of all, I gave you the example of the nitrogen case. There are more stable and better prices. And this even touches on the macroeconomy these days in terms of inflation. So here there should also be more willingness to pay from governmental actors in order to reward more resilience due to increased circularity. Employment is both a good and a bad message. The good message is unemployment will benefit from circularity. However, we really need to go proactively in terms of training the new workforce. And overall, there's a huge message. Everyone talks in Europe about the supply chain resilience. We have studies done on supply chain resilience. I can unfortunately not show it yet because this is still ongoing work. Huge benefits in terms of circularity. However, we need to recognize that many of the urban mines are not large enough yet, and we have to build them over time. And finally, we need to go for a proactive approach in terms of a public-private partnership. That's exactly what we are doing here at the Circular Republic event, where we discussed the part of the government providing this certainty in order to have smaller and larger businesses flourishing. I'm happy to go into a few questions.
Thank you very much for the insights. What I found intriguing is you talked about price stability or how prices will change, and that energy is also a big driver in the price increases, right? And you said the technology is one driver to solve this or to tackle this, and recycling, of course, only won't solve it. And you touched upon fermentation, but what are other technologies you're looking at that can contribute to tackling the security of supply and stability of prices?
So I'm very much specialized on everything that has to do with land use change, food systems. Here we look at, first of all, consumption technologies. How do we shift people's perception and, in the end, behavior to eat better for themselves and for the planet? People don't like the word so much as social technology, where it's actually quite astonishing that so many people don't eat properly. They would be much happier, more performing, and still we don't do it. You know, we drink alcohol in the evening knowing that we will have a headache the day after, which is interesting. I do it myself, so no worries. But we need to learn to have better behavior, and then marrying this up with better knowledge on how the body works. So we had a session of AI. There's lots of AI these days that gives you a better idea on your genetic makeup and whether genetically you're more a protein eater rather than carbohydrate and other things. And if you combine this with a sports program, so my son is a professional ski jumper.
Okay.
He's really big into very precise types of proteins and protein products in order to really have him at the maximum of his performance.
Yeah.
And this is something that did not really arrive yet in the larger consumer markets. However, these kind of technologies marrying up more precise proteins with consumer behavior, and then maybe even, you know, better understanding of how the body works. These are these interdisciplinary kind of new technologies I see that really have a great future.
Interesting. Okay. You also said in your presentation that the transition will create more jobs or lead to new types or more employment. However, we do have labor shortage, which you also all know. How or what's your take on how to solve that?
Well, I'm at the university, so even at the university we see that we cannot always attract enough talent just to do the research. It's a demographic issue. It's an immigration issue. It's how we as European societies work and how we open, we are open to that one. But overall, what we definitely see is that the higher knowledge shift, we really have to do that. So again, for us, but you know, as a university guy, education. That's really something that we need to think about. Also with this longer term vision, now with robotics, AI, and so forth, kind of the Marxian utopia of us being made redundant by the machines. You know, 100 years ago, he kind of predicted this, might become earlier a reality as we think, and we will have different types of employment that are emerging. So the jobs are not going away, but they will be all more knowledge intensive and capability intensive that we have now. That's for sure. So even, you know, when I tell my children what to study, it's not an easy one. Because, you know, the technologies are moving so fast.
Yeah, I bet, in research too. Another topic, I mean, that's also very much in the media these days is supply chain resilience or also sovereignty, because we're so dependent on whether it's metals or rare earth materials from China or software from the US. In so many ways, everything is interconnected, intertwined. And you said circularity definitely is also leading to more supply chain resilience. But oftentimes I see when companies have the option, they still go for the cheap or cheaper raw material from another country rather than looking at recycling, keeping it in the own market, or looking at investing more money into innovations that we become more independent. Is there, from a researcher's point of view, what is your take or your recommendation here to look at? Or also, what's your conclusion when looking at your studies?
Yeah. Well, first of all, we should not blame the companies. They actually have their rationale, they look at this quite objectively. What you see is that many of this behavior is mainly driven by some, let's say, we call it systemic risks. And this means these are rare events in markets or in politics that really create big swings. And if you believe in capitalism, then, you know, that certain participants in the market die out is just a normal thing to do. However, this is not good for the macroeconomy. And when you look at it from a pure financial and financial regulatory point of view, this is the job mainly of central banks, not even governments, to ensure that the health of the economy is constructed such that we survive it or that we actually avoid these kind of systemic risks. What this translates into is, and we are working on this quite a lot, and this is probably surprises you a little bit, I see this in your face that I'm talking about central banks, it's when you look at how money is created. Actually, banks give out money because they themselves have to survive a stress test, a financial stress test. And the biggest cost to the bank is what they call capital requirements. So they need to put money aside they would have invested otherwise in order to survive these bigger swings of the market. What we don't do is, and we never did do, is to translate this into the physical economy. So what we would need is, we would also have, let's say, transition metal requirements in the economy that would go into the stress test for companies to actually access money. So here we are devising new kind of financial rules and do simulations on this. how can we help financial markets? Because financial markets in the end are really the heavy machinery that make the transition happen. Policy is very important and gives additional impetus to it, but the bigger machinery, according to my judgment, is really the financial rules. And and here working on these physically based systemic risks and understanding them better and do better regulation, then the circular economy is just the natural thing to do and will also and will come into the market much quicker because its value in terms of risk management is properly priced. Mm-hmm. Currently, this is not done. The risk management function of circularity does not exist in the financial markets, and this is why circular companies don't get access to cheap money.
But who needs to drive this? Is this a policy framework that is needed here, or is it own initiative by companies? Where does this push need to come from,
you think? Well, of course, you need the Potocniks of the world who do policies on a European level and so forth. But these particular financial rules, these are basically done by experts that are sitting in central banks. Mm-hmm. It's the only problematic issue there is it's super non-democratic.
Super.
It's very, very expert-based. But, one could argue for systemic risks, democratic decision-making has not produced the best outcomes yet.
Mm-hmm. Before I come to my last question, also looking into the audience, this is your chance to ask a question to one of the most influential climate researchers. So take your chance if you want to. Matze, if you want.
Michael, when you were talking about jobs, I was wondering, we see so many studies these days and articles that predict that AI will take millions of jobs. You see a high shortage and you say that the solution is basically retrain. Do you have insights or maybe at least a gut feeling about the order of magnitude nevertheless? Will it overall be more or less, or to what extent is, or will we just have more jobs but with less hours each?
That's a very difficult one, because here this is completely driven by the properties of the technologies that come online. When I go and so, for example, we had Saleh, and this is a traditional coal mining region. If you really want to transition this and still keep them in carbon management, one issue would be, for example, the coal-fired power plant. You can either phase it out, or you can start co-firing with biomass and even engage in carbon capture and sequestration. Then all of a sudden, from a heavy emission machinery, you go to near carbon neutral or even carbon negative. If you spin this a little further, then, someone needs to plant the trees, someone needs to harvest them. Robots will probably do it in the next 20 years for sure. So that there's a little bit of a transition period. But what's probably will be emerging is a bioeconomy. And with the bioeconomy, you will use some of the biomass and not just simply burn it, but you will actually use it for a higher value production until it actually ends end of life. And this becomes then, this could be what we have seen, a company that produces algae. I don't remember the company who won the award, and produces leather out of it. So these kind of companies you would see in that area, where you see some jobs come in and out, but we always need to bet on the new kind of technologies and see what the properties are and how labor intensive they are. I think, I'm happy to do projections out to 2,500, which I have shown to you, but saying what are the going to be the big jobs in 2020, I cannot even tell my own children. Mm-hmm. It's really very difficult. But what's for sure is economies always created new jobs. Who would have thought? I thought when I studied originally forestry, I thought I would not need computers for my job. and I became a computer whiz afterwards. So here, making even projections for yourself, you're quite wrong many times. But in the end, and that's the beauty of the economy, we always find paid entertainment programs for us to continue propelling the economy.
Any other questions, also from the audience? Yeah, one more. Sorry.
Good. You are talking about supply chain risks and supply chain shocks. Assuming that these come from natural disasters, what would be needed to change to the land use and the bioeconomy to make sure that these shocks become less? It's not just carbon, which you just modeled, but what are sort of the broader shocks that could be that we could see, and how could they be avoided?
Ah, okay. So that's really an interesting one. So what you have is currently you have in most supply chains you have heavy concentration because of economies of scale. So you have concentrated production, the transition minerals in China, by the way, with licensing from German technology. So it's always a little more complicated. When you look at more of the bioeconomy, most of those technologies have more neutral economies of scale, simply because of a transportation issue and growing the biomass. So what you will see is, with the more circular bioeconomy, that you will have a more distributed, geographically distributed network that is for sure less vulnerable to floods and other natural disasters. So if these technology properties, like economies of scale, which are basic properties of the circular bioeconomy, automatically there will be more resilience in the overall system. But of course, this is subject to how these technologies evolve.
We're already at the end of our time, but maybe last question also, because we're here in Germany, looking at the new German government, what's your one wish or in which direction should the policies go to ensure also better resilience or also the climate policies that we need now? What would be your wish here for the German government?
This is very simple. Germany has been a technology and industry leader for so many times. Keep on trying to be a leader. Lead and don't step back. And there are so many technologies this country is leading on and doesn't fully exploit. It's a little sad. Just be daring. Go.
Just be a leader. So that's, I think, a nice sentence to finish the session off. Thank you very much. Sounds simple. I think it's a little bit probably more difficult than that, but it was a pleasure talking to you. Thank you for your insights. And with that, I think I hand over to the Circular Republic team. No, to our wonderful moderation team. Thank you.
Thank you.
This was another episode in our series about the Circular Republic Festival 2025. If you want to get the actionable one-pager about this conversation, please sign up to the Circularity FM newsletter. You can find it at www.circularity.fm. Let's drive a profitable circular economy. And please don't forget, the most abundant renewable resource is your imagination.
My name is Patrick Hübscher, and this is Circularity FM, the podcast about understanding, building, and managing circular business models.